Welcome everybody to episode 11 in the Golden Arrow series, looking back at the BDO World Championship. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Australia's Wayne Weening. How are you, Wayne?
I'm good, thanks, Andrew.
Discussing before we started recording, Victoria's had a bit of a spike in cases in the last few days, so I hope you're, you know, staying safe and staying well.
I've actually stayed right out of the way, and that's a little bit away from where I am, but I try and stay nice and secluded. I follow the rules so I can get to the pub a bit quicker.
And, I mean, what's been keeping you busy for the last 3-4 months?
I'm busy. I've kept myself busy by... I dabble a little bit with TV boxes, Android TV boxes, so that's a bit of a hobby and a pastime for me, and that's kept me a bit busy. But for the rest, I just keep my fingers in the pie a little bit with the dance that's going on around the place. There's not a lot happening, a lot of home darts, home tournaments and stuff like that, but it's movies, TV shows. I'm going to do reviews on those at some point.
Looking back at your darting career, I know you started playing darts in the 80s, but when was it you actually started playing?
Probably, I turned 15 in 1980, so I would say that's about the first time that I picked up a dart, when I was about 15, at a friend's place. So.
Did you fall in love with the sport straight away, or did it take a while for you to get engaged with it?
Well, it was a challenge. It wasn't something that came that easy to me. I understood you could throw a dart at the ball. The people that I threw some darts with really didn't have much of a clue themselves. I mean, so there was a lot that I had to learn as I went along by mistakes and stuff like that. But it was just a challenge. You know, it's like anything. Yeah, I can play around the golf and have two good shots in a round, and that's enough to make you want to come back and have another go, you know. So,
and I guess what was the route there from you playing, you know, at a friend's house to then eventually qualifying for the World Championship in 1989?
Well, it's a funny route, and we did have a discussion a couple of weeks ago where the name Bob Anderson popped up more than once in my time with darts. The same place where I first picked up a dart, a mate of mine, it was his father's place, and he was a captain of a team. He then invited us to join the team. Well, the first season that I had with him, I'm still learning, and I was keen to practice, and I was allowed to have a dartboard at home. Dad was a bit funny with the Italian tiles and stuff like that, so I had to put it out in the backyard, on the fence, with a bit of a wind draft coming through, and it was a terrible dartboard that we started on. But, you know, I was determined to get better than what I was. So I practiced, and in my first season, I started off in, I think it was B-grade side, but, you know, the quality of the players weren't great. And one player, he was basically an imported gun. That used to play years ago in A grade, and his name was Bob Anderson. And on this, I think it was about round 3 or 4, 5, and he didn't play too well, he lost. And when he sat down, I said, "Oh, you didn't play too well tonight, Bob." And he sort of gave me a bit of a scowl, and I was lucky to get a game of singles. I might get hit out the pairs or something. But during the week after that, I got a phone call from the captain. He said, "Look, I was given an ultimatum. It's either Bob Anderson goes or you go," and said, "Would you mind looking for another team?" I said, "Oh yeah, fine, no problems." So the name Bob Anderson jumped up at me then, and it took a bit of a turn then, because I went down to another level, which was, I think it was E grade or something like that, that we went to. And as I said, the gradings weren't fantastic, but at least these people had a bit of an idea. It was a good bunch of blokes, and I slowly improved. I practiced, and I slowly improved. Until one day, I found myself at Lakeside, at Bob Potter's Emporium.
And I say, you mentioned the name Bob Anderson. It was actually quite fitting that the first time you qualified for the World Championship, you beat Cliff Lazarenko in the first round, and then your opponent in the last 16 was Bob Anderson at the time, the defending world champion.
I had a lot of respect for Bob Anderson. I actually got to know him a little bit in I think the first time I met him was up at in Northern Territory while we were on our national championships, and we played the Pacific Masters. And at that time, the Pacific Masters carried good BDO points, and players like Bob, Eric John Pauling, people like that have all been jockey, Mike Gregory. They've all come and play in our major events. Keith Dallow was there as well a couple of times. But in Darwin, I met him in 1987, and I was lucky enough to beat him in the tournament the day before the Pacific Masters. I beat him in the semi-final, and it was just amazing. And we had a couple more battles. He went on to win the Pacific Masters the following day. I didn't do as well. Then we met up in the World Cup 12 months later. In 2 years later, it was 1989 in Canada, and where Australia defeated England 9-2 in the semi-final of the teams event. We eventually got beat by Canada, the home state, main country at that stage. But a couple of times we crossed paths, and one of the nicest men you could ever meet on the tour. You know, always had a word, always had time. It just made you feel comfortable. So when I got the play of it, Lakeside, I had no fear of him, but I just watched him. He had a shot at nine data actually against me in one of the legs. I started the leg and I ended up having a data and a double. I hit 340s on the trot, and he was throwing second. He's hit the 2180s and 60-57 and missed a double 12. And I've had a shot at double 12 myself for a 12 data, and then he's come out. But what a player. What a good man.
Do you remember how it was that you actually qualified for that first World Championship?
I think I was recommended to Ollie by Terry O'Day. Terry had qualified, and I was next in line, but Terry very graciously said to Ollie he wasn't going to be travelling and they should give me a crack over there. So I got the... That was 1989, start of 89. So 88, we were over there for the World Masters, and then 89, I'd beaten Terry in the semi-final of the Australian singles, and I think that was the thing that swayed him to convince Ollie that, you know, if they were looking for another spot, he was going to go and maybe take me. I don't know where my ranking... I was still a little bit green in the areas of knowing how to qualify or what points to get in that top thing at that stage, 1988. But, it was a welcome gift. I never stopped thanking, really, you know, for that opportunity.
A couple of years later, you know, you had one of the big moments in your career. You won the World Cup pairs alongside Keith Sullivan. And, of course, you know, one of the big games in that tournament, you beat the pair of John Lowe and Eric Bristow, who at the time were, you know, seen as almost unbeatable on that World Cup stage.
Yeah, I didn't know of their record until I knew Eric and John, but I didn't know of their record in the World Cup pairs until after we knocked them off, Keith and I. And we beat them handsomely too, 4-1. I think it was a quarter final. And afterwards, I'd learned that the only time they'd ever lost the World Cup pairs was to Tony Brown and Cliff Lazarenko. And that was in New Zealand in 81. But they'd won every other time that they paired up. And it was a bit funny, actually, the story, because Keith was quite fired up at this point. He'd was in Zandvoort in 1991, and the setup was in a horseshoe shape. And Keith was scheduled to meet Eric Bristow in singles. And Eric went to Ollie, and he said to Ollie, he said, look, this game's no good for where it's scheduled. And it was scheduled for the inside of this horseshoe. There was boards on the outside and boards on the inside. And he said, that's no good. He said, people are going to want to watch this game. This is going to be a cracking game. And Ollie's gone, yeah, all right, I'll go and ask him to change it. So he's went up to the control table, and Ollie's got it changed. And Keith's mesmerised. He said, how did they change my board from the inside where it was scheduled to the outside? And so Eric beat, and I'm not sure what the scoreline was. I think about 4-2. And Eric come up and said, he says, your mate's not too happy with me. I don't think I'm going to be getting a Christmas card off him this year. And I said, why would it happen? And then I wasn't aware because I was busy playing singles myself. And he told me what had happened. I said, oh, okay. And then we were scheduled to meet John and Eric half an hour later. in the pairs, and Keith was fired right up, and we played a really good match against John and Eric. And I said to Eric afterwards, I said, "Well, I guess I won't be getting any Christmas cards off." and he had a bit of a laugh. Eric is quite cheeky. He loved a good bit of banter, and I think that he sort of enjoyed the fact that I could have banter with him, and that's all it was at the end of the day. You know, good fun.
I mean, that must have been a hugely, you know, a proud moment in your career, not only representing your country in the World Cup, but, you know, winning a title for your country at a World Cup.
It was a moment that we can still relish today. It was the first time Australia ever won a gold medal at the World Cup. And we'd been about doing some good work in different areas. Russell and Terry, Kevin White, and George Foster, they'd actually won. Kevin White and George Foster won the Unicorn World Pairs some years earlier. But at the World Cup, Australia had only managed to receive a silver medal in the teams event 1 year. But a gold medal was still elusive. But we picked it up that year, and it was something that Australia, they still talk about it today. It's well listed, and they're very proud of that moment. We've since won it again. The World Cup Pairs won by Jeff Kime and Tony Fleet. They won it. And then the boys won the world, won the teams event gold medal, so, which was fantastic. But yeah, to be the first gold medalist for Australia, something that I get to talk about from time to time at a barbecue.
Moving forward to 1993, you got to the British Open semi-finals at the start of the year, and then a week or so later, you know, you were back at Lakeside and you got to the quarter-finals, which at the time was, you know, as good as any Australian before you had managed to do. I mean, what are your memories of that year?
There was a fair bit going on. At the start of 93, there was the split with PDC. They were WDC at the time. And all the people that we used to rub shoulders with, Bob Anderson, all the other guys, it was a little bit different because they were a little bit protective of what was going on at the time. And there was a bit of an icy feeling with the boys because they had rules and where they wore dinner jackets and the like, or suits, ties, the logo, the WDC, which is a little bit in your face to Ollie and the like. And Keith and I at the time, because Keith stayed with Bob Anderson for a little bit, we sort of knew what was going on, but we weren't allowed to go to the meetings because we weren't members. But they were asking us to become members. And there was no issues with becoming a member, but we wanted to know what the benefits were for us as you know, players, and because we're a long way away from anyone in Australia. And the only way that Keith and I were managed to get overseas at any time was via representing our country. And then what we tried to do was pick up a tournament here and there while we're on the run, you know. The feeling at the time was a bit weird because they were tight-lipped about what their plans were, and yet it was a big move, and that move shining today in the PDC. But for us at the time, it was a bit strange to be in that environment where Ollie, you could see the strain on Ollie, and that he wasn't happy with the players were sort of cold-shouldering everyone and being a bit cheeky and, you know, brandishing the WDC logo. But they needed to make a stand for something because there was nothing much happening on TV except for two events here. The British Open at the time, or the World Masters. The British Open even lost the TV. I think it was the World Masters and Lakeside. So there were only two, maybe three events that they had on TV. And I think in their peak, they had about six. And that was relatively new for us. So going into that and then playing a few people, and I think I ended up drawing up against Rod Harrington first match, and he was the number four seed at the time. And I enjoyed playing, and the pace of the game was fine. It suited me. The stage was fine. I was used to it and all that sort of stuff. So, but I didn't have the consistency as the other guys. But what I did have, I believed I had the ability to be able to finish games, and I didn't have the fear of hitting the double. or to get my combinations right. So, and I got opportunities and I took them, and I believe that, you know. Walking away from that in 93, at the start of the year, we went into a World Cup then later on that year in October in Las Vegas. And, of course, all the big names were there that year from 91 to 92, and that Eric John Phil was there, and Al Morena. Then all of a sudden it was, I think, Steve Beaton and Martin Adams, I think it was, when they were still a formidable team, but it wasn't Eric and John like everybody. When they walked in the room, it was different, you know. So that World Cup year was a little bit strange because the talk was that Dick Alex and Tommy Cox were in Las Vegas and they were looking to come in to talk to players, try to, everyone, the fear-mongering, you know, they were going to poach players to come and join the WDC at the time. And I'm not quite sure if the ruling had gone through at that stage, because it took a bit from WDC to PDC. They were told that they weren't allowed to enter the dining room or the hotel until such time that the official World Cup was over, which I thought was really weird, you know, because, I mean, they were just managers looking to, you know, talk to players and offer them opportunities. And, you know, there weren't a lot of opportunities in darts, but when something came up, a chance to brandish a logo or something like that, with the BDO and Darts Australia, they were all very small-minded when it came allow you to wear sponsorship. You know, like if the dart tournament was sponsored by one particular company, they wouldn't allow you to wear your sponsor's logo anywhere, you know, rather than the PDC doing a lot better with that, but the BDO and Darts Australia really didn't. So with Tommy and Dick coming in, and once we played the World Open, I think it was after the World Cup was finished, and they were allowed in, we had a bit of a chat then, and I explained to both of them at the time, I would have loved to have been part of it and really open up and had a shot, but my only chance of getting overseas at the time, which I told them, was if I did it via representing my country. So that was in 93, so I managed to go to the World Cup in 95, 97, 99 as well. So I had three World Cups, six World Cups in my country, and I played some Pacific Cups as well, you know, in between. It was a bit of a weird year in 93 with all that happening.
You didn't make the switch to the WDC, later the PDC, but I guess it would have been particularly difficult if you or Keith or any of the others had made that decision, because, you know, at home, Darts Australia were very, very closely affiliated with the BDO.
But the worst thing was, like, Darts Australia, at the time they were called the Darts Federation of Australia, they didn't know. They only knew what Ollie told them, and they believed what Ollie told them. And that was fine. Ollie was protecting the BDO and the WDF, and Australia wanted to honour whatever Ollie had, because he was God, you know, still for a long time when it came to running or being the man in charge of the darts. But our officials here were naive in the sense to think that everything what Ollie said was 100% correct, you know. But Ollie was saying things that was protecting his organisation as well. I'm not saying what he said was good or bad, because I liked Ollie a lot, and he invited me into his home, and he was a friend, so I supported him anyway. But our officials had no idea. So that made things really hard for us back home, because all our competition was structured at the time. There was no Dart Players Australia, no DPA, who were affiliated with the PDC, who I now tournament director with. There was no, they started in 2000, so this is prior to them starting up. There was nothing for us here. So everything that was going on, we were dictated to by Darts Australia. It was either that or you played non-affiliated league, you didn't go anywhere. So we didn't have any opportunities to go overseas. A little bit different in the US, where the ADO really had no control on darts in America, because everyone's entitled to do what they want over there. If you want to play for America in the World Cup, you had to do ADO stuff, but you could play anywhere, do anything. Soft tip flourished over there as well, you know, it was really good. So being over here was a little bit more tight-fisted, and we couldn't just play where we wanted.
looking back at the Lakeside after 1993, when you got to the quarterfinal, you were there three more times, and I mean, you played some really big names in the game. And I mean, you know, two of those years you played Ted Hankey and Richie Burnett. I mean, what were your experiences and memories of those last three appearances?
I never did a lot of research on who I was playing or anything like that. I had no idea really who Ted was, and Ted was pretty cheeky, to be honest. We stood at the bar and we were yapping away, and I was giving a little bit of advice, really. They said, "Oh yeah, look, it's a game, but you know, you're putting on the show, but you know, trying to win and blah blah blah." And he absolutely belted me. You know, I mean, I didn't play too badly against him, but he was really solid. I had no idea of his county matches or how he'd played or his standing in England darts, to be honest. I never really worried who I was playing next or anything like that, whether it be Jockey, John Lowe, Eric. I played against all of them over time, and it never fazed me who anyone was. You know, I was happy to play them. I just wish I knew a little bit more about them, or was interested in knowing a bit more about them. And you know, I'm not saying it could have changed things, but maybe I would have mentally been a little bit different when the games. But I didn't really care. I just went and played, you know, and I didn't always go in as prepared as I should have been. I almost took it for granted at one stage that I was playing, you know, because it was fairly easy for me to enter a tournament and win it over here. And then going over there, I didn't feel any... I always sort of managed to go deep into events. You know, like you said, the British Open, I got to the semi-final 1 year. Ted was one of those guys we had the conversation, went up stage, played... The rivalry's not there. I loved how he portrayed himself on the stage after that. The people, you know, the count, and like, I'd probably come on as a count against me. That was his thing. But he's one of the really, really good guys. You know, like his persona on stage was just for the dance and the crowd. He's one of the nicest blokes that I met as well. You know, I seem to get on with everyone though. I don't know why. I always bought him a drink first, and maybe that, like, you know, they like that about me. I don't know, you know. But I found myself not that I didn't feel I was out of depth, but I didn't do enough to really, become professional at that level, you know. And I wasn't, and I was sort of just going over there, and it was hit and miss, you know. They either have a good run or a good draw or something, but played some really good plays, and I'm really grateful for it. I got to meet some of the greats in the game. Leighton Rees got me on the snuff, the Birmingham snuff, I think it was, that he had. He really, one of the really good guys as well. Huge respect for the players, professionals, because the first time I got to meet them, I'd seen John and Jockey. They did an exhibition in my hometown, and a Scouse mate of mine, and he was a better player than me at the time. We paired up in the exhibition and beat him in the pairs. And that was, yeah, to the crowd, the light, you know, to a couple of local boys taking on, you know, John and Jockey. So, but I got to know those. But the only other time we ever knew was with videotapes that were sent over, which is normally 3 months after the tournament had been and gone, and someone had recorded the event. And I got to know the players that way, and you looked at it and go, wow, look at that, how good's that, you know, the stage, that type of thing. It was the inspiration of wanting to get you, you know, wanting to get you over there. Mm-hmm. And then Richie, absolute champion. I heard his interview that you did a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, wow, you know, it's good to hear Richie's voice again. He's one of the, and it's an echo, but he's one of the really good guys as well. I got to catch up with Richie some years later. He beat me in the final of the tournament over in Australia some time ago, I think 2004 or 5 or something like that. And he was touring with Bob and Keith Della, Jamie Harvey. There was four of them that come over. And it was good to catch up with them at the time. And then there's been another touring party since. But Richie was one of the good guys. Good player, really good player. I don't know why. I got on really well with the Welsh. The year I beat Rod Harrington, a friend of mine, Alan Black, took me back to Newport And he lived down the road from the pub, and I walked in, and I couldn't buy a drink. You know, they just loved it. Like, hey, you know, you beat the Pom. He's the name that beat the Englishman or whatever they said. It's quite funny. But all those little experiences, and I didn't realise when we first spoke, you know, I said, oh, look, I wasn't sure if I'd have a lot to say. You know, my memory hasn't been great. But since talking about it, because I try not to talk about the darts or what, you know, I don't know. I always turned my dart case down. If it had my name on it, we were given a gift one year. And the dart cases had our names embroidered on it. But I'd always turned it face down on the bar. I was a little bit more humble or shy. I didn't want, if I was in general public, they didn't need to know when I was, you know, a good dart player. I always got introduced as, oh, he's champion this and champion that. But I just wanted to be, you know, average Joe at the barbecue with an interesting conversation about the politics or something, you know.
Mm.
I didn't think I'd have many stories or memories, but talking about them with you, and it sparked a few memories, a few good memories. It's made me, you know, lay awake at night and really remember things and the pleasant times playing darts.
So, you know, you mentioned that the only real times you got to come over from Australia were for, you know, for World Cups, and you tried to tag on tournaments and so on. And I guess one of those tournaments that you were able to come over and do was the Swedish Open, which you won in 1995, and it was an amazing field that year, and you came through and eventually beat Steve Beaton in the final.
That is, I often look at the trophy in Mum's lounge and reminisce about that particular event. I also remember when the Australian team was named to go over to Sweden. I said to our organisers at the time, I said, if you haven't got any flights booked yet, there's a tournament. Let's book in for a tournament. There's a tournament a week before the World Cup at the Swedish Open. I said, if we fly in London, and then we can get a free stopover to Sweden and back. So it costs it no more to fly, you know, because you always get one stopover. So I said, we fly direct, have a stopover, come back, and then head to the Swedish Open. And we did that. And it was one of the best things ever, because I got the experience. A field as big as, the British Open, I knew, you know, I think there was 1,500 that they used to allow in the morning and 1,500 at night in the second session. But a big field and a big room and the way that it was absolutely brilliant tournament to remember winning. Steve Beaton in the final, and we're good mates today, Steve and I. And I think I beat Chris Mason in the quarterfinal, and I beat Kevin Painter in the semi-final of that event. So I was lucky. I had a good run, and then got over a couple of really class players. You know, maybe I slowed them down a little bit. I don't know.
And I guess the last point on your playing career, I know you were playing, you know, events in Australia up until about 5 years ago, but why was it that you sort of stopped playing and sort of retired from that side of things?
Probably around about 2000, I'd stopped being serious about the game. I'd retired from international darts, and I was building a house. My son was two years old, and we bought some land and built a house out in the country. And so I thought to myself, I'd spent 20 years doing the selfish thing for me. Now I have to give him, you know, give the family something. And I was ready to do that. I slowly came back and played again, bits and pieces, but my heart wasn't in it the same way. I'd come back dribs and drabs. I played a few events, a few tournaments over here, won a couple of major tournaments when I first came back, but I didn't have the desire to put the time in on the practice board, and everyone else was getting a little bit better, and I'd been pretty much of a leader for such a long time. So my name was still getting me some wins, but my drive to work at the game to make it better wasn't there anymore. And then one day I thought I'd go to the Australian Grand Masters in Canberra to have a look and say goodbye to a lot of people, basically as a player. And I had a bit of an injury happen to my foot. The ligaments in around my foot had loosened up a bit, and the bone structure had collapsed, And because I'm a diabetic, I have some neuropathy in my feet. I didn't feel the pain as such, but I felt like it had gone to sleep in the middle of the match, like the pins and needles that you get. And that's the sensation. It wasn't like a piercing pain or anything like that. So I was trying to shake it off, and I was in the middle of the final of a board to get into the quarterfinals. It was the last 16 match, and it started happening. I was trying to shake it off, and I got through the match no problem. And I had to play Tony David then in the quarterfinal, and about 15 minutes after the board fall, and my foot, I started getting a bit of a pain in my foot, and I had no idea. What it was, I'm thinking I must have kicked the corner of the hockey or something like that. They were steel framed dartboards, and I must have hit that. But as it turned out, the pain got to such on the way. We were 7 hours from home in Canberra driving, and by the time we got home, my foot had swollen, and I had a bit of bit of blood coming to the surface. I wasn't torn or anything like that, but you could see that it was well bruised and bleeding. And so the next morning I'd gone to the emergency section, and eventually, cut a long story short, what they said was that I'd busted my bones in my foot. So I was pushing off, it was my right foot, I was pushing off, and it was just akin to being in a road trauma. So they took x-rays and they asked for my permission to show all the different hospitals for their tuition to see how bad a foot can get. Yeah, so I was on my back for 18 months in a cast every week, come off as the foot, the shrinking, the swelling sort of went down. I had an open wound where it rubbed and opened, and the bone was pushing on it. I dislocated one of the biggest bones in the foot. I don't know what the name of it is. Tony's really good at remembering medical things, but I'm not. I sort of listen to it and said, okay, you're just fixing that. That's me. But they end up having to take 2 centimetres off to allow the wound to close. That was after 18 months. But I was getting a cast, a new cast. They'd put one on, and fiberglass cast, and I'd take it off a week later and get a new one put on. Every week I'd visit the hospital for 3 hours and wait my turn, get the cast taken off, put it back on again. I had a bit of fun with the cast. In October 1 year, I had a hot pink cast put on on my foot, and I went to the Oktoberfest celebrations on crutches and the hot pink cast. And the guy put the cast on, he said, I can't believe you'd go through with that. I said, why? He said, oh, hey, because you're a bit of a blokey bloke. I said, and that's why I'm going to get away with it, I said. and it was fine. It was in support of cancer. I think it was October. And then we had Australia Day. That was a blue and white and red with white, the Southern Cross on the boot. Celebrations, so I had the cast done in that, and they actually quite liked it. Then in the end, they thought it was quite good, something different for them. I did a Christmas one with green and red, decorated it, so it was a bit of fun. But
going back slightly, you were saying that you tried, once you sort of stopped playing, the international level and stuff, you tried to kind of move away and keep your darts career a little bit quiet. Was it, I guess, that that chapter of your career for you had finished, and it was now time to focus on being, a family man?
It was. Look, and it was the fact that I was trying to focus as a family man that kept me a little bit sane. I've looked into things and people's behaviours over the time for different things. I actually felt a little lost without the game, the need. The desire to be Ray Barneveld, he probably summed it up. He felt he wasn't winning anything, and that's why he wanted to stop playing, But there's a drive that you have to succeed, to be recognised, to be heralded for who you are and all that sort of stuff, and that feeds your motivation to do things. But when it got to a certain point, and I decided I wasn't going to play anymore. I felt a little lost that I didn't have that anymore, and I missed it. I did miss it. And when things weren't going well with my son's mother, and we parted ways, I thought I'd have another crack and get amongst the people that I like being amongst, you know, because it wasn't so much the competition, but the people, you know, the people were good people in darts, and they become your family in a way, you know. So I thought I'd have another crack at it, and but I just didn't have the drive then to put the time in on the board to be the player than I was before, hungry, selfish, you know, with time and time management for practice and that kind of thing.
You mentioned your son, Brandon, there. He's obviously now, you know, starting to forge a dark career of his own, and I guess it must be good for him to have you in his corner, kind of like being able to guide him and advise him. It's also nice for you to kind of live those experiences again through him.
Oh, absolutely. I sit there without fear. I watch him play. I really love watching him play. I have no worries if he doesn't succeed. Sometimes I think, you know, you made a mistake. I hope you get punished for it now, so you'll learn from it. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes it gets a bit easy for some people, but he was making mistakes and getting away with them, and I thought, well, you know, he's a real gutsy little player, puts a bit of time in. He actually this year qualified as the number one qualifier for the World Youth Championship for Australia, but it doesn't look like we're going to be going overseas. I was going to be coming over with him, but I love watching him play, you know. So he has a different drive. He started, and I didn't push him. I had no I never put a board up for him at the start. I didn't even encourage him to go and play. He went to his mother's one day, and she had a friend over, and the friend asked Brandon if he wanted to come along with her. And he said, oh, yeah, no worries, I'll come along. I think he was 14 or 15 at the time, and he had no idea how to play. I didn't have a board up here. And he didn't have any darts, you know, but he just borrowed some darts and filled in somewhere. And then he goes, oh, I was playing, I'm going to start playing Super League. And I said, hey, you know, and over here, Super League's a bit different than over in England, of course. And I let it go for a bit. And then he said, oh, can I have a dartboard? And, you know, this and that. So I put a dartboard up for him, and he wears them out. He actually wears them out. I can't believe it, you know. Like, I used to be a little bit more conservative with him because I was paying for mine. You know? He seems to benefit from, you know, whatever I can help him out with. He's bang on. I've never seen anyone wear out dartboards like he does. You know? He's had a couple of good wins as well against some really good players. So he qualified. He pushed me. He said, Dad, I want to go here. I want to go try out this. And I said, son, you're not ready to play that. He said, why? I said, you've got to learn to count. And my son's not a natural, he's not a natural numbers person. Schooling wasn't his best subject, you know, mathematics wasn't. And he still struggles with it a bit, but he's remembered certain combinations and, you know, he sort of gets by. All right. I took him to Victorian under-25s tryout one year, and he finished 7th out of 18 players or something like that. And only took the first four players. But I knew that the second four could put a team in because it was actually held in Victoria. But I didn't want him to know that. I thought he just wasn't ready. But he had the experience of the round robin. He had the experience of learning the disappointment and of not making the side, and let him build up, you know. And he did. And the following year he finished 3rd in the 18-man field, and then come away, after coming away playing, he was one of the best players that they had. That's come away, picked up, made top averages, he picked up a win in the triples, so he really relished it, loved it, and he sent me a photo. There was a photo of him bearing the flag for Victoria, and he sent it to me. He said, oh, someone said I look like you, you know. So that's now my profile picture, is when he's in the photo and I'm in the boat at two different times. So, but yeah, he's a funny young fella. You know, he's got a good sense of humour. He's got a really good game to him when he gets going. He's, he's managed to beat some good players. He beat Corey Cadney a couple of times, and he's gone looking for him to play him. He's beat Mal Cumming as well. He's won a tournament with Justin Thompson, Australian number one. He's won a tournament with him, playing pairs with him. Justin did that as a play to me, played with him, and said they played well. So, you know, it's all learning for him. And I thought, well, good on you. You qualified to go over to the World Youth Championship, PDC World Youth, and we're not allowed to travel. I actually learned to watch darts. I never used to be, like, as a player, I wasn't interested in watching anyone else play darts. Even at Lakeside, all the years I went over, I think I only stayed the full week twice or something. And we were always, at that time, we were always covered, while we were there as international players. If we stayed, we got an allowance to be there every day, and we got, we had our room sub for us and all that sort of stuff. So we were there in support of the darts and looked after. But I do enjoy living the game through here. With the watching of the darts, I became an Australian selector for 3 years. And I learned to watch the darts. I had to watch both men and women's darts. And they thought it was quite funny because I really didn't have a lot of time at the championships for when the women, because we always waited. The amount of time, I think I made 7 or 8 Australian singles finals and I won 2. But I used to wait 1.5 hours, 2 hours, 3 hours sometimes to play our final. And I just didn't deal with that in the best way, you know, like waiting for the women to finish theirs so then they could then play their final and then leave the room so we could play our final. Do you know what I mean? Like, we were waiting, you know, 2 hours quite often from the time we'd won our semi-final until the time we got the plane. So anyway, I was watching a lot of darts during the championships as a selector. I'm a stats man. So I'm in the room a lot and I'm watching a lot. I wasn't watching for the A or anything like that. I was just in the room just seeing matchups and that type of thing, you know, see how they how it all went. But I learned to watch the game then, and I was comfortable with it then, not to be playing anymore. I think that was the point where I learned that I didn't have to play anymore.
You know, you mentioned earlier on you are the tournament director for the Dart Players Australia now. I guess, when did that role come about and what does it actually, you know, entail you doing?
Well, that's funny. I was heading to Bondi for the Darts Australia National Championships as a selector. And for the 5 days prior to that tournament, that championships, there was the DPA were hosting the World Series qualifiers in Warilla in Sydney. Both places were in Sydney, and I thought, what a good chance to catch a few players trying to qualify through and, you know, get a bit of a read on how they're travelling. Disappointing to learn that there was not as many players decided to make that trip as I thought that they would. But while I was there, Rob Denny, the CEO, he said to me that while I was there, if I wanted to give him a bit of a hand, I could look after the drug testing and a couple other things. So we're always on about trying to get results to the social media a lot quicker. So I was basically doing a bit of floor controlling for him, taking results, making sure matches kept moving, looked after the official drug testing, made sure that those nominated was a random draw, that they were aware of what was expected of them at certain times. I made sure that as an ex-player that they weren't, that they were notified as early as possible before the draw was announced. And I made sure that they understood that I wasn't just going to pick them up and say, like, now you have to get tested. Their obligations in matches and while they were still playing could be fulfilled. And then once they finished their matches and their marking duties and all that. So I sort of I had a good rapport with the players and Rob looked after me a little bit there and he thanked me for the job that I did to help me out. I was more I was there in a capacity to watch the game and watch the players, but I helped them out and I was happy to do that because dart players are dart players, aren't they, you know? And I went off to Bondi and I spent 10 days there with Darts Australia and the championships. And it was a really long 10 days. We had some technical issues, and so the selectors spent a lot of time in the back making sure that the results were all correct. Didn't get out, spent long hours there, didn't really enjoy it, but it wore me out. And I was up for renewal, to renew my application. Every 2 years, the position was up for renewal. And I was up for renewal, and they asked me if I was put my name in. I said, when does it have to be in by? And I said, Mama, I said, look, it's been an exhausting sort of week. Give me a week or so, or give me a bit of time, and I'll let you know in due time. So I'd gone home. I was supposed to be captain of the world. I'd got home on a Sunday. Raymond was flying into Melbourne after, I think, they had Auckland. I was due to meet him on the Tuesday. So he was in Melbourne on Monday. He'd come to Melbourne on Monday. And I flew home on the Sunday morning. So I was really worn out. And Ray likes to collect pop vinyls. And he has a big collection. And we had a store in Geelong. And he said, oh, do you know where this is? So I arranged to go and pick them up. And then we spent the day here in Geelong looking for pop vinyls and a few other things. And he asked me if I was going to the dance. And I said, well, I don't really think I am. You know? And he said, why is that? And I said, well, I said, I'm just tired. Just, you know, I said, I'll just, I said, I've had, you know, 20 days away or something like that. And I said, I'm just going to give it a miss and watch it from home. I said, but thanks anyway. Because you can come as my guest. And I said, so after the World Series in Melbourne, Rob Denny asked me if I was interested in doing the job as tournament director. And I said, well, you've got a tournament director. I said, I don't want to be standing on anybody's toes. I said, you know, it's fine. And he said to me at the time, he said, look, I want him to do something else. He said, I want you to, he said, the players respect you and they listen to you. So if I have Matt doing other things and then you do that, then that's fine. I said, well, as long as I'm not stepping on anybody's toes, I'll consider it. I said, when do you need to know by? He said, well, you know, I said, well, if I make a decision, I said, I don't want any announcements made until I speak to Darts Australia and let them know where I am. So I wanted to do it with the right, you know, my loyalty's with dart players and the darts. And I've got a really good relationship with a lot of the good officials and the players. And I wanted to show them that, you know, things can be done in a proper manner, which I believe that they were. When I made my decision, I let Rob Denny know that I was going to take the job. I said, you need to give me some time. I said, I need to write my resignation to Darts Australia, thanking them for the opportunities and whatever else. And, which I did. And I spoke to Calvin, and he thanked me for the input that I had. So I accepted. So the following, I ran their championships that year, and they had over 200 players, a couple of championships. That was quite a large thing. So you're running teams, events, round robins for men's teams, youth teams, ladies teams, girls youth teams. Then you've got different competitions for the men, the women, and the youth, running four of those events at a time. And Dart Connect was being used for the very first time. I sort of got involved with that a little bit before. That was probably 2 months after I'd accepted, you know, and we did some work. So, and then the following year, I kicked it off with, and then we were Dart Connect from that transition period there. But it was hard because we were unique here in Australia with our events, as we play a lot of round robins. Mainly because we weren't getting huge crowds. That's one. And when venues put money up, we need to keep them there in a knockout. They sort of leave early, don't they? Darts do. So in round robins, they, you know, play 5 matches over the course of a day. So it can drag on a bit if it's not run properly. But run a lot of round robins. And Dart Connect didn't really know how to do the round robins at the time. So we worked tirelessly with them, explaining what we were looking for, and which we got to at the end, you know. So it's worked out really well. Our system that we've got in place now, just the players love it. They know the formats. They know that they turn up at a certain time. We enforce all the PDC rules. We try to adopt everything that they have, and we emulate that, so they're in preparation for it whenever they go. So the drinking rule while they're playing, all that sort of stuff, and we force it, and sometimes it's harsh, but well, I've had to rule people out for drinking or, you know, different things like that. So, but I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed being around the game, and this year was good because Brandon chose to play in the DPA circuit, and he's managed to hold on to his seeding. He was around about the 10, 11 and 12 mark for the season. He played four or five events and sitting on about 60-odd points or something like that. And for him as a young kid first year in, because the DPA circuit's a pretty tough circuit. They're well-experienced players. They know what they want. The attitude of the players are really good too. They bit different than a little knockout comp here and there where you might get a bit of attitude from players, but these guys are really good that play. They know exactly what they want from the game. It's very similar to what the PDC Players Championships are about, you know, same sort of respect, playing conditions, that type of thing. So we hope that we can continue to feed the PDC competition with some players by being professional in what we do, and so the players, they only have to worry about playing, nothing else, you know. And we try very hard to emulate that. But the players that have come through, the likes of Corey Cappy and Paul Nicholson was probably the first one to break through and made a bit of a mark. And then Simon come along, Kyle. We had a few players through the Oceanic that have turned up and played, but these guys have made impact in the tournaments. And in the years that they've played, you know, so Simon still is. Damon Heater, he won our event last year. Topped the our rankings, and I think he won a few events. So he's, you know, alerted a few people that he can play, and they all want to be part of him. And then we get hit with this COVID-19, and that sort of stops everything, doesn't it?
The last question from me, I guess, looking back, what would you say was the, you know, your favourite memory from your darting career?
Favourite memory. I have a couple. There's a couple of highlight moments which are fantastic, and there's a lot of memories. When I look at the greats of the game and getting to know some of them on a, you know, personal level, to me, I think that'll hold the greatest memory for me. The people that you get to know, and you know, I've made some really good friends over there. I had Barney, I had Merv King, Dave Whitcomb, Eric, of course. I got on my old jockey. John was a little bit different, a little bit quieter. I respected all those players. Alan Warriner, Steve Beaton, all those players I got to be friends. I felt good friends with. So those memories I can talk about with my son and give him something to look forward to make his own memories one day, you know. I can't put my finger on any one particular thing. I'm very proud of getting that gold medal for Australia. I was so pleased to always be remembered on that trophy, Swedish Open. But the people that I met in the game, that's my greatest memory.
Well, a huge thank you from me, Wayne, for giving up so much of your time. You know, well, the morning for me, the evening for you, but it's been fascinating to learn about your career and your journey and, you know, the work you're still doing in the sport. So thank you so much for your time.
The pleasure was mine, Andrew. I really appreciate you contacting me, asking me to be part of your show. It's, I've enjoyed your interviews that you've done in the past, and I'm a little bit chuffed, really, that you asked. If I'd be interested, so.
Well, thank you once again, Wayne. I really do appreciate it.
More than welcome, Andrew. Good luck to you, good health to you, and I look forward to hearing your future interviews.